So, this session is a panel discussion by four or three people, and the basic idea that we're going to be discussing is the whole idea of S-bonds, right? Their usefulness, caveats of using them, and all these wonderful things. The rest of the day, everybody was talking about S-bonds as like something, you know, that has to be there, and we all know what information has to be there. But maybe this is not so obvious to anyone, and the whole idea is to discuss the idea of S-bonds. Right, so we have, for the moment, three panelists, and the format will be that they will be doing a very short introduction of, I don't know, the problem statement, if you want. Right, and then we'll, after these three short introductions, we'll go into more discussions, and we obviously would value audience participation. So, first up.
Yeah. Right. Okay, afternoon. My name's Anthony Harrison. I used to work for a very large system integrator, so the work on safe functional safety was very close at heart. Certainly the things like the Siemens team as well, very similar to the sort of things I used to be involved in for many years. I retired a few months ago, but before I left, I was trying to introduce S-bonds into my organisation, and it was following very much on from the Log4j need. Where was the components, which systems were affected, which customers needed to be informed, and where was our liability, very much from a risk perspective. So since I've retired, I've been writing Python tools. So if you want to talk about me about some of the Python tools I've been doing, because it's been quite interesting, have a chat with me afterwards. But to sort of set the scene, I think we've got four types of users. And it picks up on what Adolfo was saying. Is Adolfo? Yes. About who's a supplier. Is a supplier a developer? Is it, I've put the word supplier in there, but basically someone who packages things together. It might be an embedded solution. It might be a Red Hat. It might be someone else. And then you've got your integrators, which is like your Siemens, people who are selling solutions to an end user who's going to use it. And I believe that if you are a producer of S-bombs, you also should be a consumer of S-bombs, first and foremost, because there should be value to you in what you are producing, and you need to know where your vulnerabilities are, whether you're compliant with your licenses, as we've had lots of discussion about, but also where are things changing, particularly do you know those changes, are those changing happening under your control or not? And this comes into the ecosystems, things happening outside your Maven repositories, etc. So the first thing is, I think everybody who's a consumer, everyone who's a generator, should also be consuming. So if you've seen some of the questions I'm asking this morning, was when the Yocto guys were saying they're generating an SPDX S-bomb, are they actually using it? I think the answer is most definitely yes, you should be. And then what are the sort of things you should be using them for? We've heard a lot about vulnerability management on the basis, but that's heavily dependent on the quality of your S-bombs. Have you got your components uniquely identified in a way that they can be found consistently? Secondly, looking at license management, again, are we consistent? But thirdly, looking at for change management, are versions of packages changing? Are licenses changing? And I was telling you to Kate, on an open source project I'm involved in, we generate an S-bomb every week and we do a build, and we are seeing components changing versions, and the metadata is changing with those versions. Sometimes it's getting worse. So why have we lost the name of the supplier or the developer? And fourthly, I think you should be using it for solution integrity. have you built what you said you were going to design? So we're picking up on the design S-bomb that Nico was talking about from the safety. I think that would be really good to actually use the S-bombs as part of a solution integrity. Have you built what you said you were going to build? We saw a lot of that things with the checksums from the Yocto guys. Have we got end-of-life components? Are we planning for removing those end-of-life components, obsolete components? And are we seeing the impact of those changes on the solution comes back into the onto the engineering life cycle? So I think all of it is supporting risk. So ultimately, this is all about risk management. And hopefully, SBOM and all these are helping you make effective decisions. Now, I'll shut up now. but the thing, just to try and just shape, that's where just to try and shape things for discussion.
Okay, thanks. My name's Paul Novaries. I'm a solutions engineer for a company called Anchor. We produce a couple of open source projects that A, can produce SBOMs for, in some cases, do vulnerability checks against them so you can look up SIFT and GRIPE. I'm not going to talk specifically about any particular projects here. So just to hit on the topic of the panel, I'm going to just jump into a couple of things. Well, what I do there, I'm out in the field. So I am a solutions architect. I'm working directly with the end users a lot of the times. So most of my contact is with people who are on the beginning of the learning curve, right? They may not even know what an SBOM is the first time I talk to them, but they've been given marching orders, right? So, you know, it spans a pretty wide range. So as far as content, the biggest thing for me is that the SBOM, and this seems to be somewhat of a controversial statement sometimes, but the SBOM needs to be seen as a objective document that only has factual information in it and does not have judgments in it, right? Those things are important, but should be separated out a lot of the times. A lot of people probably haven't been in here all day, but there have been off and on, you know, comments about should we include CVEs in an SBOM. My opinion is probably not, because those are going to change more than the software that the SBOM describes, right? Obviously, if you rebuild the piece of software, then you would want to build a new SBOM, but the SBOM should be static as long as the software it's describing is static, right? So in the case of a Docker image, right, we know when that changes because the image digest would change. We could trigger a new build. But we shouldn't necessarily be rebuilding those SBOMs continually if there's nothing new there. Now, that ignores things like maybe our scanner has gotten better and can detect more things. Obviously, that might be an exception to that kind of rule. The other thing, you know, just as far as content goes, the first thing we mentioned today, right, the specs, whether it's SPDX, Cyclone DX, are extremely loose. You can have a valid SBOM that doesn't actually have enough information to be useful for your particular use case, right? And what that minimum amount of useful information is might be different depending on the use case. So there's just something to keep in mind. The other thing that's kind of come up again and again today, the quality of the SBOM is going to be really dependent on the tooling, right? There's no way to do these things without automation at scale, right? It's just too difficult to keep up with. The tooling is improving, but still a long way to go, I think. Usefulness, the main thing here for me is the SBOM is useful because it's going to make all the other aspects of supply chain security better, right? So one, you know, what's in the software? That's the SBOM, right? It's kind of foundational to all the other aspects. Two would be things like, is the software safe to use? Does it have vulnerabilities? What are those vulnerabilities? What is my license? You know, am I at risk for some kind of compliance issue there? Right, those kind of safety issues, whether you know, I don't want to use that term after seeing the operational safety discussion. The other thing, provenance, you know, where is this coming from, right? That if you know what's in that software, having that assurance of where it comes from and what's in there together is a much more powerful. And then things like reproducibility. It's really esoteric, very difficult to actually achieve in practice. But if you have an SBOM, a high quality SBOM, it can be effectively a recipe towards that. And that can also help you prove some of the other things that you've seen or we've been talking about, right? A lot of this is difficult, though. You know, we've seen a lot of things about opaque artifacts and things, you know, the difficulty of actually scanning at build time, which may produce a higher quality SBOM, but at a lot of cost, right, performance and other things. So that kind of leads us into the caveats. I mean, the main thing here is to keep in mind that our imagined state of how we want things to be and the actual reality are basically not the same at all. You know, we'll try to move towards that, right? We're on a journey up the mountain, whatever you want to say. We're probably, like if you're climbing Mount Everest, we probably haven't even gotten to base camp yet, right? So there's a long way to go. But the other thing, like in that realm, like just declaring we have a policy to produce or store or evaluate SBOMs doesn't actually solve the problems you're trying to solve. There's a lot more work that has to be done. And the last thing on caveats, things like Log4Shell, I think gave, it pushed SBOMs into a lot of people's awareness because it was, SBOMs were a very effective way of finding where Log4Shell was affecting software. It may have given kind of a false sense of security just because Log4j in particular like sticks out like a sore thumb. It's very easy to find. Things like the OpenSSL vulnerability just a couple of months ago, I think, may have been a reality check there. There are a lot of cases where you might have something like OpenSSL in software that you're consuming without even knowing it, right? It's a lot easier to hide. So just kind of a reality check, bring some people back to earth a little bit. And then the last thing is just, in addition to producing SBOMs, one caveat is you have to think about managing them after you produce them, right? Storing them, being able to search them, purge the ones you don't need anymore. That's been a topic of a couple of times, like we don't want to keep more information than we really need, right? So how do we know when it's safe or reasonable to get rid of some of this data? Much less how are we going to search through it when we need to find it? So I think that covers it for now. I'll go ahead and I think I'm up over time anyway. Thank you.
Like you, I've attended more panels than I've been on, and I don't like a panel that is a series of talks, and I did hear Alexo say that I needed to make a very brief introduction, so mine will be, I promise I'm timing here, I'll be under 2.5 minutes. My favorite childhood, I'm Bradley Kuhn, I work for an organization, a charity called the Software Freedom Conservancy. My primary job has been related to copyleft license compliance since 1997. And so I've seen a lot with regard to that issue, which does interact quite frequently with the issue that you are here to discuss today of software bills of materials. My favorite childhood story, by the way, is the story of the Emperor Has No Clothes. And I found throughout my career in open source and free software that I'm often the only one willing to say that our emperors have no clothes. I think SBOMs is a case where that needs to be said, at least to a certain extent. The most useful application of SBOMs is in cases where you are in an organization that produces proprietary and open source software together in products. If you are an organization that is 100% open source and free software and choose a copyleft license, your usefulness of SBOMs is extremely limited, almost to the point that you may not even want to invest in getting involved in this kind of thing. Now, I'm a realist and realize that almost all of you probably work for organizations, including the trade associations among you, that produce lots of proprietary software. As such, you're going to have to worry about all these issues we've been hearing about today. Many of the tools today looked very interesting to me to solve those kinds of problems. But I want to leave you with one thought, if I can. That is, imagine if there was no proprietary software in your organization, that you didn't sell it, you didn't use it, and you didn't want to make it. And instead, you chose to look at the requirements of the copyleft licenses, like the GPL, which require you to produce the complete corresponding source code as a reproducible build every time you produce a binary. And you have to make that available to every customer you have. SBOMs are most often needed when you don't necessarily have all the source code to hand, or don't know if it's going to be to hand when you get something from another vendor. So my argument is that the level of effort that's being put into SBOMs is primarily to enable the continued production of proprietary software. Being at FOSDEM and being a free software activist my whole career, that's generally not something that I'm that excited about, which is why I'm not excited about SBOMs.
So, okay, so we heard opening statements about uses, about general use and caveats of using them and why they're not needed. Or in an ideal world, they're not needed. Okay, let's go back to that. Bradley, even if in an ideal world where an organization is producing free and open source software and following license obligations, they provide all the source for every release they're doing, right? There might still be the use case that I want to find out which of my releases slash products or whatever you want to call them contain a vulnerable version of a library, right?
So if you have a lot of source code, there's this great tool, it's called grep. And what you can do is you can search the entire source code and look if a version of something is in there. If you have all the source code for everything,
it's always easier,
and you never separate the source from the binary,
right.
Why does grep not work? You tell me.
Because it's easier to search a table of contents than the complete book, right? That's why we have table of contents and indexes, right?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, since things have become electronic, I generally just search turn the PDF into text and grep anymore. I don't use table of contents.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so we have a source file. I used to write C. It used to be full of hashed ifdefs. So how do I, if I search the source code, I will find a line of code, but it's not telling me whether that line of code was actually compiled into the binary and now actually on my target architecture, target hardware. So how do we get around that? So we've talked about having sort of a trail of evidence from the source code to a binary, so we can then sort of match the two together. If we have different compile options, I would expect we'll get different binaries, I hope. So therefore, how do we accommodate that? Just to keep the argument going.
So I'd love to. And so in the world I'm imagining, which does not exist, I agree with you. This is why you have to do this work, because the world that I've been working towards my whole career doesn't exist. But if it did, and all software was under the Affero GPL, you would be required, every time you build a binary, to make sure you had a reproducible build that could produce that binary. So when you found a vulnerability in that binary, you would have stored the complete corresponding source release right next to all the binaries. You take the binary that's sitting out in the field, you compare the checksum to the binary in your repository of binaries and source code, and voila, there's your source code release that you made at the time you built it years ago. Simple enough.
Yeah, I'm going to I get it, right? Yes, theoretically, we should be able to reproduce everything 100%. But in practice, like, we don't do things like inspect every jar of food that's coming off the assembly line. We only inspect some of them just for scalability purposes. So the SBOM still has a value there in providing a shortcut so that you don't have to do a bunch of work over and over and over again on demand every time. It does, I get it though, you're right. In an ideal universe, that would be true. When we have unlimited time, unlimited, you know, compute resources to do all these reproducible builds, in practice, though, even if there aren't constraints on time and compute resource, reproducible builds are extremely limited in, you know, I mean,
so it takes a replacement for reproducible.
No. But they can approximate a lot of what you would get out of it. Not everything. No, not everything. But you can approximate some things, right? So, I don't. I mean, I agree with you in principle that reproducible builds would prove a lot of things, everything, right? That would absolutely solve a lot of problems, but I don't know if everybody is really willing to live in that world.
Yeah. My view is, be the change you want to be in the world. That's why I support reproducible builds instead of investing in S-bombs.
Yeah. I think part of our disagreement here of different views is the slide that Kate showed in the beginning, that we're not talking about an S-bomb. So there are different type of S-bombs, right? And there are S-bombs that apply to the source, and there are S-bombs showing what the build is or what the deploy thing is and stuff like that, right? Now, to Bradley's point, once you have everything documented and provided, people can recreate this information, right? So the GREP example that Bradley said, this is looking at the source, right? But if the obligations are, we don't only give the source, but also all the build instructions and all the scripts that the license obligations require, right? So people can go and recreate it and then try to find out this information. Right, but so the information will be there. Right, the question is how easy we want it to have. Right. Sorry, you wanted. Yep. Nope.
Why don't you take questions?
Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's talk.
Maybe one comment. So I think I completely agree with you that it is better to take such decisions on the sources. But what is missing to do this is that the current vulnerability databases that we have only reference vulnerabilities in giving it names, naming components. So there is a link missing of a vulnerability is present in this file, in this function, with this method signature, and so forth. And so I do not know what you want to search with. But if you only search for CVE blah, 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 you will not be able to catch all instances of the vulnerable code because maybe a project has been forked, renamed, the code has been rebundled, and so forth. So that is, I think, lacking.